Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Australian and New Zealand Studies podcast on the New Books Network. Bede Haynes here. I would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which I live and pay my respects to elders past, present and future. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with Melissa Harper, who has published a book called The Ways of the Bushwalker. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Bede.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
And your dog's welcome as well.
Yes, sorry.
Okay. Now, Melissa is a senior lecturer at the University of Queensland in the School of Communication and Arts within its Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences. Melissa has a PhD from Sydney University with research interests extending into social and environmental history and politics, with a speciality in the history of Australian bushwalking and research into Australian food culture. And if I can be so bold as to say so, this author can write a book. It's not just an academic book. It reads very, very well, which was an absolute pleasure to get a book with academic depth and a real style for writing. So I'll begin with the back of the book. It says, Australians have always loved to step out into nature, whether off track or along a marked route, bushwalking an organised long distance walk in rugged terrain that requires maps, camping equipment or a family day out is one of our most popular pastimes. This landmark book, now updated, was the first to delve into the rich and sometimes quirky history of bushwalking. From its earliest days of European settlement, colonists found pleasure in leisurely strolls throughout the bush, collecting flowers, sketching, bird watching, and picnicking. Yet over time, walking for the sake of walking became the dominant motive. Walking clubs proliferated, railways organized mystery hikes attended by thousands, and Paddy Palin established his equipment business. Bushwalking, serious walking, was invented. Now, Melissa, I would like to ask you how you came to write this book.
Long genesis actually came from when I was doing my honours degree at the Uni of Sydney. In the previous year, I'd done a course on Sydney Between the Wars, and I looked at tourism in the Blue Mountains in the 1920s and 30s, and I just realised that bushwalking was really growing at that time and that its history hadn't really been explored. And so for my honours project, I looked at organised bushwalking in New South Wales, again, in focusing on that interwar period, and then decided that, you know, this was a story that really needed to be told in terms of that longer and more extensive history of bushwalking throughout Australia. So I embarked on the PhD and then it became a book.
Well, that's fantastic. Now, could you, one thing I did comment earlier on your writing style, and it does seem to me to have some unique features for an academic book. And one technique I liked, I'm not sure if this was a conscious choice, but I'd just like you to comment a little bit on the writing style, is throughout the book, it provides a social history of bushwalking in this country and an environmental history. And then it's punctuated with these little stories of various people who do important things, and you talk about them. So you have George Morrison or William Hamlet, and that the stories just begin. There's no introduction to them. It's just you're reading along, and then this story just begins, and you've never heard of this person before. And at first I think, gosh, this is a little bit uncomfortable, but then you get used to the technique and it's just great. It doesn't, there's no fanfare. You just built into the story. Was that a conscious decision?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, one of the things that I really wanted to do when I wrote this, even as a PhD, was, you know, I was very conscious that I wanted it to be a book for the general reader. I didn't want to write a stodgy academic text. I wanted it to be really, you know, based on strong academic research. But, you know, I wanted, I mean, I think bushwalking as such a popular Australian activity, it deserves to be something that is read broadly. So I really focused, you know, I'm really pleased that you've made those comments about the writing, because it was something I really worked hard at. And I really did focus on storytelling. And I guess that's what really drew me to the topic in many ways, because, like you say, there are all these really interesting people and interesting ways in which they walked in the bush. So I really did want to just put those front and centre, those kinds of stories of different kinds of people, because they help to bring to life the range of walking that took place in Australia and in a longer history than I had anticipated when I started. I really thought I would be focusing on the 20th century, and, you know, as I just did more and more research, it just took me further and further back, and, yeah, all these fascinating characters.
Well, that's great. Now, the way I would like to progress this interview to get you to talk about your knowledge of this area and inform all of us is to progress through a few subject areas. And the first one I want to begin with and ask you a little bit about is what walking actually is and the societal role that it has. And I'd like to invite you to talk with one image you put at the beginning of the book, which is you make this reference to in the 1700s in England, Jane Austen had her characters often walking from places for leisure. So walking was no longer a form of transport for these people, but it was converted into pleasure. Is that how you would think about what your part of this project was, to actually talk about walking as being something besides simply walking because you don't have a car or a horse, into something else?
Yeah, definitely. So that really became a defining feature of what walking was, and the kind of walking that I wanted to look at was that idea of walking for pleasure. So that was a kind of defining characteristic, because, as you say, you know, I mean, walking was a form of transport, and particularly for people who couldn't afford, you know, a horse. So walking was a real sign of poverty, or at least being lower down the social scale, you know, in Great Britain. So if you had a horse, you know, it meant you didn't have to walk. If you were walking, it usually meant, well, you couldn't afford other modes of transport. But in something like Austen, when you have those people who could afford to ride, you know, to use other forms of transport, but they were choosing to walk, you know, something else sort of starts to happen, and they're choosing to walk because they're wanting to experience the outdoor environment. I love some of the ways in which Austen uses walking, and as do other novelists at that time. It really shows you the way in which walking was becoming an important part social life, because it was something that people would do to, you know, turn about the garden with someone else, you know, have a conversation. It might be a time of a solitary pursuit. It might be something that people did when they wanted to think and just to sort of connect with their inner self or connect with the environment on their own. It was pleasure in the act of walking, and also in the environment that people were walking in. So also that, you know, that romantic walking that people like Wordsworth and Coleridge and wrote about in their poetry as well, that real connection with the environment.
Yes, and with that notion of the romantic style of walking, when it came to Australia, one I'd like you to comment on in the early days of the settlement in Australia, there seemed to be an idea that some people thought we can walk around Australia as though it's England, but then they couldn't because Australia is a rugged country, or at least where people settled was quite rugged in Sydney. And walking seemed to have taken on a different type of role, of being more about discovery and exploration and actually making somewhere to walk. So could you comment on that?
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, the environment was just so different, often heavily forested, as you say. So there weren't sort of, I mean, there were Aboriginal paths. So there were sort of tracks in a sense, but, of course, early colonists didn't know where they were going. So walking was this sort of opportunity to discover what the local environment was like. And, of course, they were often enormously curious about this new place that they were in, because for them the trees were different, the shrubs were different, the climate was different. And so they really used walking as, it was about scientific discovery. So botanizers would be looking at the plants, etc. And those were kind of, things like, botany and being interested in natural history were quite common pursuits of the elites at that time, and so of people that came to Australia. So walking was that, really did become for many early colonists that way in which they would come to know the environment, but often also, they found it difficult. So one of the first people that I talk about as a walker in Australia was George Morgan, who was a surgeon on the First Fleet. And he writes about his walks that he undertakes. So for him, he doesn't need to go into the bush, really. He's going in there with other people who are interested more in the plants, people who are sort of botanizing often, or shooting, they're taking their weapons in there as well. So there's the idea of walking for sport. For him, it was just this curiosity. He wanted to see what the environment was like, and he wrote about it to his brother. And he talks about, the damage, the bush tearing at their clothes, setting up a wigwam at night and lighting a fire and, sitting around a campfire drinking and eating the sort of salted meat that they've taken. There's quite a few instances like that where people are writing about walking. And you can kind of easily miss when, in reading the early accounts of walking, I think sometimes those, because walking is just such a taken-for-granted activity, you can often miss, sometimes it took me a while, in terms of reading those early accounts to, there's someone walking, they're walking for this reason, they're walking for a different reason. That was, that sort of process of really just working back and seeing the range of walking that people were undertaking.
Yes. And another aspect of the early days of European settlement in Australia seems to have been an inability at first, but then they gradually come to get this ability. And I'd like to ask you about this, is how the Australian landscape and the Australian bush could be seen as being beautiful in its own right, rather than as being a poor match to what England offered with its soft woodlands and flowing creeks. And there seems to have been a role in that for art, landscape painting, photography, and also, if you could mention Guide Alice. Alice Manfield is a lady you mentioned. She seems to have had a role in this as well.
Yeah, that's right. So, as you say, it does take a while, and it's, I guess it's different, for different people as well. Some people, really from the very early 1800s, are experiencing great pleasure and finding beauty in the bush. George Boys is another one that comes to mind, from very early times. Although often for him it was because the sort of beauty was there, was because it was a reminder of being with his family in, wooded locations in England. But gradually there is that sense in which people become more familiar with the environment here. So, various artists from the 1850s, von Gerhard was one, and particularly as we move towards the end of the 19th century, so, the Heidelberg School of Art is really influential, because it's that idea that artists are, and it's, you know, it's a bit of mythologizing goes on, but sort of seeing Australia through Australian eyes rather than through, you know, English eyes. So that sense in which, yeah, people are becoming more familiar and finding the gums attractive, because often, you know, I mean, they are very different. Like you say, they're not that sort of soft green. There isn't the change of the seasons in the same way. So, you know, the gum tree for some could seem monotonous and, you know, ugly. I mean, I find that such a hard way to look at them, because I think they're so beautiful. But I guess, yeah, in those days when you're used to such a different environment. So, again, your artists are really playing an important role there. And yes, photographers. So photographers are going into places, you know, at the end of the 19th century, like the Blue Mountains in Sydney, and starting to take photographs that would often be displayed in trains, for example. So, that, you know, this is when you're getting that beginning of what we might think of as bush tourism or nature tourism in the 1880s, 1890s. And Guy Dallas in Mount Buffalo in Victoria was really important in that area in encouraging people to walk in that sort of late 19th, early 20th century. And so, you know, her family went to that area as farmers, but they diversified, you know, and recognised that people were starting to, because of the growth of the railways, that played a hugely important role in being able to take people from city locations to those, you know, more distant locations from the city, like Blue Mountains, like Hillsville, like Mount Buffalo in Victoria. So the trains were absolutely crucial to this as well. And I guess you know, what also should be understood too is that people actually having leisure time. So, again, this is more, you know, upper middle and middle class people at this particular time that are getting that sort of leisure time so they can take up this opportunity. So people like, you know, John Monash, I mean, he is, again, he's, I think, a fascinating story, one of our war generals, and people would know him from his career there in World War One. But he, you know, in his youth was an inveterate walker and was somebody that visited Mount Buffalo time and again and stayed at the Manfields' very rudimentary chalet. Sometimes they camped as well. And, yeah, Guy Dallas led walks. Monash writes about Guy Dallas. And she, you know, she made herself this amazing pantsuit, which she walked in, which attracted quite a lot of interest in its own right, because to have a woman, you know, for a start, leading people on walks through, you know, this mountainous terrain that she knew very well, but they didn't, and wearing pants. So she did have an outfit as well that was a skirt, but she really liked her pantsuit. And became quite well known for this pantsuit that she wore when she took people on walks. So yeah, she you know, she's another fabulous character that facilitated that rise of bush tourism in that period.
Right, and with women and their access to bushland and their dress, that appears to have remained relatively controversial, probably up until the 1950s. And there was even church movements to try and restrain the evil effects of women walking in the bush, particularly in pants. And there was a famous female bushwalker who walked bare feet.
Yes.
Could you comment on the role of, well, why women were treated like this in the bush, and just to comment on the social history around that?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the bush became such a part of an emerging Australian identity in the 1880s and 1890s, and it was really the kind of bush that was celebrated in that, and, you know, in the art, in the literature, so in poetry, you know, and short stories of people like Lawson and Banjo Paterson. The bush that they're really celebrating was the working bush, you know, the rural settlements, the sheep and the cattle. And so that was very much seen as a male environment, and it really valorised the bushman, the bush worker, you know, the swagman. There are some. I mean, there is the drover's wife in Lawson and Barbara Baton. But, you know, for the most part, yeah, the bush was seen as this very male environment and not a place for women. And so when you're getting people going to the bush for leisure and going into those forested environments, you know, that idea that this was an activity because it was physically demanding. The attitudes towards women at that time were that they, you know, weren't capable of walking. So the first bushwalking clubs that formed in the 1890s, they tended to be male only. It took a while for you had some sort of female clubs that emerged in 1922 in Melbourne, for example, and a mixed club in Sydney in 1927. But yeah, so bushwalking was women were often discriminated against. There was a men's walking club, the Warragamba Walking Club, and they would have ladies' days. So they would invite women and then be, you know, surprised because women could act, they demonstrated despite wearing these, you know, voluminous 19th century dresses, they demonstrated that they were perfectly capable of walking. And similarly, there are quite a few newspaper accounts in that period in the early 20th century as well about women walking and, you know, sort of attracting attention and people being surprised about their abilities. As you get into the 20s and 30s, you know, which is really when bushwalking becomes incredibly popular and you do get this sort of craze for hiking, sort of a different version of bushwalking, you know, women are really demonstrating that they can walk, and yes, they are challenging social norms around physical capability and around dress. So, I mean, the wearing of shorts for both men and women was controversial. You know, now it's so commonplace that we would wear shorts, but even in the 1920s. For men. So to leave work on a Saturday afternoon to get onto a train in your walking gear, because that was sort of quite unusual, people would comment and laugh at men and women wearing shorts. And, you know, they'd sort of think men were going off to play a game of football. But, yeah, even more controversial for women. So in the Melbourne Women's Walking Club, I mean, the photos of those women in the 1920s, they tended to wear steel skirts or bloomers rather than shorts. So Dot Butler, the bushwalker that you referred to, who became known as the barefoot bushwalker, she really sort of, and this is really in the late 1920s and early 1930s that she's embracing bushwalking and rock climbing as well as a activity. And yeah, likes to go barefoot, and she just really showed what, you know, women were capable of. But even some of the women that were in the Sydney Bushwalkers, which was the club that Dot joined, they were also a little bit scandalised by, you know, her short shorts. She liked to wear her shorts very short, and she liked hanging. You know, she liked being with the blokes. She liked hanging out with the men and showing that she was just as capable as they were of. Undertaking these, you know, really difficult walks and climbs. So, you know, yeah, women faced discrimination, but, you know, gradually it became an acceptable activity for women to do. Although, you know, the activity still was quite often quite gendered. Bushwalking clubs often, you know, it was sort of men were still the ones that led the walks and knew how to map read and etc. Women could do that stuff too, but men tended to put themselves forward as the ones best equipped to do that. So yeah, that, you know, that took a while before there was a sort of much more equal acceptance for women.
Mm. Well, that's, and in your answer there, you mentioned the craze that happened. I think it was the 1930s where there were just thousands and thousands of people going off to these organised bushwalks you made a distinction between bushwalking and hiking. So could you comment on that distinction and just this try and explain this social phenomenon of these massive bushwalks that seem to have happened en masse, but not for that long.
Yeah, sure. So what really started to happen in the 1920s, as people are organising into bushwalking clubs, and clubs facilitate, people being able to go further than they had before, because they're, with other people that are really serious and keen about it. So they're going on, overnight walks or walks of, a few days or even weeks. And so what particularly happens there amongst clubs in Sydney and Melbourne and Hobart at this time is this distinction develops between the real bushwalker, the serious bushwalker, was somebody who knew how to do that, to be self-sufficient in the bush for, several days at a time. So you could carry all your own gear, which included your tent, your sleeping bag. You were able to, cook your meals in the bush find your way, use a map and a compass. So this sort of idea developed that this was bushwalking, real bushwalking. And even that term, I mean, one of the things that, I think is really interesting is that the term bushwalking, this is when it actually develops. So you might have had instances prior to this where the two terms might have been used, when someone, I went for a bushwalk, but it wasn't kind of conceptualized that that was an actual term. People just tended to talk about walking. And so when the Sydney Bushwalkers forms in 1927, the term actually starts to get used more and more, and gradually it becomes picked up as the term that we use in Australia to describe, going for a walk in the bush for pleasure. But it is, in a sense, really commandeered by serious bushwalkers. And so when you also get sort of a broader a range of people who are wanting to go to the bush and might not be so experienced, might not be interested in going on a long walk, but still want to have that experience, the term hiking starts to be used to describe that. And so there's this real sort of tension that emerges in the late 20s and early 30s between serious bushwalkers and hikers. And serious walkers, this is really played out in Sydney, serious walkers saw hikers as amateurs, where they were the professionals, and the mystery hikes was something that really fostered the idea. I mean, introduced, I suppose, in a way, that idea of hiking as a term, and increased that tension. So, what happened with the mystery hikes? They were, as you say, in the winter months of 1932. They happened in other parts of the world as well, in the UK and in North America. Just this very short-lived phenomenon where the railways were behind them. So it was sort of a money-making venture for them. So you would turn up at Central Station in the various cities and buy your ticket and not know where you were going. So that was the mystery. And you would hop on the train and the train would take you, to a station where you would then get out and go for a walk. And there could be, as you say, thousands of people. So in Sydney, some of these walks, I think that the largest one attracted 8,000 people. In some of the smaller cities like Brisbane, there were sort of several hundred. But they sort of followed a similar kind of pattern in that they were enjoyed by, there might be children as well as, lots of young people. I mean, it's seen as a very much a youth-oriented movement, but also older people. So, there might be people in the 80s, they would often be commented on in the newspaper. So they encouraged, participation from across the ages and also different classes. The bushwalking clubs tended to be very middle class, whereas hiking also attracted people from, working class as well. And they would be, during the day as well, you'd stop for lunch. And there might be people who were on hand there to sell drinks or, sweets. There might be a band that would play. So it's a very different idea of what we think of, as a bushwalk. So you can see why serious bushwalkers would find this kind of walking and not really appropriate to that idea of getting away. Serious bushwalking was about really getting off the beaten track, whereas these walks took place, on wide kind of roads. And so they were controversial for serious bushwalkers, but they were also very controversial for the churches because they were on a Sunday and they were used by the railways to make money. And so, you know, we're used to everything being open now on a Sunday, but in the 1930s, Sunday was supposed to be a day of rest. You know, so even if you weren't going to church, it was just supposed to be a quiet family day. So the idea of the church is actually making money on a Sunday was something that many of them, of the railways making money, was something that the church has railed against. And so the newspapers, I mean, I just loved, you know, looking at those newspapers because they were full of stories about these mystery hikes, photographs. Lots of the newspapers got behind them, but they also published criticism from the churches, letters to, you know, loads of letters to the editor, editorials. Yeah, so they were very controversial, but then really just, I think, petered out because I think partly, I mean, because they did attract such a wide range of people who weren't necessarily, you know, lovers of bushwalking. It was just that they went because, oh, all their friends were going. And they were something that happened in those cooler months. So when they tried again to do it in the sort of cooler months the next year, there just wasn't the same kind of interest. Just something that happened and then off it went. But I think it also did help to encourage others to, you know, experience walking, hiking, bushwalking, whatever people wanted to call it, but in smaller groups.
Right. Then, Melissa, the book takes this interesting, well, I thought it was an interesting turn, and where you tell a story about Federation Peak and Beckerwaes, I think that's how you pronounce his name, climbing Federation Peak in the 1940s. And Federation Peak is in the south of Tasmania in a very remote area, as I understand it, a very difficult climb. And Mr. Beckerwaes climbed it and left a pile of rocks on top as his landmark and proof of his conquest and took some photos. And there's a wonderful contrast, which is what I'd like you to comment on, is the idea that this is in the 1940s, so there's no longer anything necessarily to discover in Australia, as the Europeans like to do. But seems to be this concept of, if there is land that is unknown to the Europeans, it's just some uninhabited land that must be not only walked through, but in some way conquered. Some way, the pinnacle of climbing through that land is to get to the top of this thing called Federation Peak, as though the land before that happened was just this, as we say in Australia, terra nullius, this uninhabited land. So the local indigenous people, their connection with it seems to become redundant, and all it's about is these conquests. I'd like you to comment on that.
Yeah, and I think it's really evident in the example that you use with Federation Peak. But I think too, I mean, we really see that sort of in the history of bushwalking, you know, in the 19th and into the 20th century in Australia. So there is that thread that bushwalkers feel like they are, yeah, walking in these unknown lands, and that they are explorers, and they very much position themselves as explorers discovering unknown lands, you know, really not recognising that, well, actually, hang on a sec, you know, we're walking here in places that have been walked for thousands of years. So like you say, they kind of ignored, neglected that long, long history and positioned themselves as explorers. So, yes, and so there was a real thread in, you know, in bushwalking that's so highly visible with something like wanting to conquer Federation Peak, yeah, of it being about the destination. So sometimes you would have an achievement, you know, rather than that kind of just wanting to slowly walk through an environment and sort of take your time. You know, there would often be tensions within bushwalking clubs between people who wanted to experience the bush that way and those who wanted to, right, it all has to be about achievement and conquering and, you know, we are the explorers. So, yeah, I think that thread really is borne out with that. And that sort of just, yeah, seeing if there was recognition of, you know, Aboriginal people, it still tended to be that they would be positioned as, that, you know, not there anymore. That was in the past. There wasn't a recognition and acknowledgement of a living culture, and as you say, of people who had that connection with place. So that's sort of something that's only really relatively recently, I think, changed within bushwalking.
Right, and I'd like to ask, along a similar line, a recurring person in your book is Miles Dunphy, who was a cardiographer, and he appears to have been perhaps the most central person in the 20th century almost in Australian bushwalking. And he made these amazing maps where he mapped all these places. And there's two concepts I'd like to touch upon. The first is there a relationship between the European idea of mapping everything, and until something has a name on a map, it's just nothing. It doesn't exist yet. It's just an unknown point, and a place gains significance when it is actually named on a map. But then I think Miles might have been one of the first to start calling things, if he could, by the local indigenous names, or at least referring to them in some of his maps. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, so you're right that he's, really significant, because he was one of the early developers of bushwalking clubs, and also because he was a real, he was one of these really serious bushwalkers that really pushed the idea that people who were undertaking this serious sort of walking were developing something new, a new kind of activity. And he did produce volumes, there's boxes and boxes of his material in the Mitchell Library, because he writes about, all his works, beautiful scripts. He just had the most, beautiful handwriting as a draftsman and architect. Was fine penmanship, which you really see again in his maps that he produced. So, he was really important for that, because he was helping to provide ways that other people could then, find their way in the bush. But, he did tap into that idea that, that this was an empty land, and as you say, that kind of idea really was evident that, unless you mapped and named, the place wasn't known. So, again, it was overriding that kind of mapping and naming that had gone on in a very different way by Indigenous people. But, yes, he did use Indigenous place names where he could. So there was that sort of recognition that was slowly making its way, sort of, felt, I suppose, in the in bushwalking in Australia. And Duffy was one of the people, and his son as well, Milo, did recognise that there was an Indigenous history. But as I say, it tended to be recognised as history, not as a living culture.
Right, I see. And yeah. I'd like to... there's another Miles Dunphy story that I'd like to switch to a little bit about conservation and the role of national parks, because you tell the story of how the Blue Gum Forest in the Gross Valley in the Blue Mountains was saved from a leaseholder who planned, I think, to clear it or clear a significant part of it. And then there's national park movement seems to arise. I'd like you to comment on the role of conservation and national parks, and even then within that there seems to be a tension between, as you've said before, the real bushwalkers who really wanted to have this available only to them, as opposed to, say, people who wanted to drive into national parks.
Yeah, so I mean, we had, Australia was very early when we look at the history of national parks throughout the world. So we did have some of the earliest national parks, Royal National Park in Sydney, for example, from 1879. But those early national parks, they did very much tend to be about recreation. So that was a sort of real focus more than conservation. So Dunphy was really important, and, with fellow bushwalkers, in terms of encouraging, we really need to take care of these places that we're finding and enjoying and that are becoming so special to us. They are under threat, so they need to be protected. So, yes, Blue Gum Forest in the Blue Mountains was an early example of a campaign that really was pushed by bushwalkers, but they were also very fortunate to get some funds from W.J. Cleary, who was with the railways and sort of tourism that helped them take over the lease, I think it was, of that area and save, you know, this stunning area. But, yeah, Dunphy really pushed for the idea of the Blue Mountains having this, you know, being a big national park. I mean, that would take many, 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 many years. But he was just tireless in his efforts, to sort of campaign, but quietly too. I mean, in a way, a kind of quiet activism, you know, not out there marching on the streets. And similarly, you know, he's passed that on to his son. So Milo Dunphy was somebody who took Bob Carr into the bush and really encouraged Carr to see the beauty of the environment and the need to protect it. So, yeah, bushwalkers, I think it's often overlooked the role that walkers like Dunphy, but, you know, a whole range of others, and organisations like the National Parks Association, you know, across throughout Australia have played in encouraging walking, but also encouraging that preservation and conservation of the bush. But yes, tensions in those national park movements, you know, that Dunphy was sort of really pushing, because, as you say, they often did want, they wanted places that could only be for serious bushwalkers. You know, they didn't want roads, they didn't want easy access. They wanted it to be something that was difficult as well, you know, because it was sort of, the idea was, oh, if it's difficult, it's really worthwhile, you know. And we want it to be about getting away. We want it to be about preserving these relatively untouched places. If you put in roads and picnic tables, et cetera, you're sort of taking away from that idea of getting away from it all. So that, I guess that's what we're often still striving to achieve now, is some kind of balance between different recreational interests, and there's so much more competition now. Yeah.
I was going to say as well, with this concept again of real bushwalking, and I think Paddy Palin, who owns a fashion or bushwalking camping business, said real bushwalkers don't get lost. I imagine it just means they just keep walking or something. There's no end. There's no end. It's like a Nike ad. There's no finish line.
Yes. And I guess he just was thinking, well, you know, yeah, if you're a real bushwalker, you will know how to get yourself out of a situation. If you do find yourself somewhere where you're not really sure where you are, you know, because you are walking in areas where there aren't tracks, or kind of really detailed maps, that you will have the skill to find your way out. And that would be the kind of the marker of that real bushwalker idea. So, but Paddy Palin too, I mean, he's, you know, fascinating, because he also was, he was broader in his view of what bushwalking could be than Dunphy was. So he helped to establish, you know, a club that would cater to Europeans who didn't necessarily, you know, who came to Australia sort of post-World War II and might have found our environment a little bit alien, different to what they were used to. So he wanted, again, you know, people who were different skills. And I guess, you know, he kind of needed to, because that helped his business, you know, if he made bushwalking more accessible to a wider range of people. But I think often people now might not even be aware that when they see a Paddy Palin camping and equipment shop, that, you know, Paddy was a real person, someone who came to Australia from the UK and set up his camping and equipment business shop in the middle of a depression, you know, when he lost his job. Interesting time to set up a new business, but, you know, it grew from being in a room in his house where he would, you know, make the packs and with a sewing machine, to this, you know, huge business that it's become today. So, again, yeah, that equipment, I think, is really important to consider, the role that having equipment that helps, you know, that makes things that little bit easier for us to, you know, carry in relative comfort, you know, because early packs were often military designs and they weren't comfortable, they weren't really appropriate. you know, same with walking boots and tents. You know, we've had to, it's taken a long time for lightweight fabrics to develop, for example. So, yeah, Patty, you know, again, one of the characters, I suppose, that I just developed a huge amount of interest and respect and affection for in the book and wanting to tell their story.
One thing you also like you to comment on is you draw out this almost contradiction or strong contrast between, as if you people who are familiar with Sydney, and it's probably the same in lots of capital cities around the world, there's a camping section in the city, in Sydney. There's about 8 or 10 shops along a street in the CBD, and they all have camping equipment. And it seems that, I imagine it's all quite good, but the real test in one way for the person, like if I walked into that shop, I would be the most, I would feel the most pleased if I bought the most expensive thing, and it's just something to wear, even if I never go to the bush. It has a real cachet about it, and it seems to have created the contrast that you can look like the true bushwalker, but never ever leave a metropolitan area.
Yeah, I mean, I think that idea. I mean, like I said, Paddy Powell formed in the 1930s, there weren't a lot of equipment shops really until the 1970s. And that's when you get, you know, your Mountain Designs, Kathmandu, et cetera, gradually forming and establishing a kind of camping line in a particular street. And then the gear gets, ever more diverse and colourful and expensive. Yeah, you know, really, like you say, really expensive. So, people can feel like they have the right gear, can look the part. Although, again, you know, what you often would find there is a serious bushwalker would kind of look down on them and think, oh, they're just newbies. They just, you know, they're going out and they're getting all the good gear, but do they actually know how to use it? Do they have the skill? So that kind of hierarchy, you know, serious bushwalkers would often hang on to their Paddy Powell pack, even if all these new designs had emerged, which might be more comfortable, but they were so wedded to their older equipment that seemed then more authentic because it was, you know, it was bashed around by all the experiences they'd had, whereas someone, you know, out there with their new gear or that might just be wearing the gear on the street, they might actually be looked down upon a little bit by the serious walker.
Well, then I'd like to focus now on, it almost follows on from that there's been the rise of what's known as eco-tourism, and you give a couple of great examples in the book of talking about these raised tracks or these ways of making the bush wilderness more accessible, but it's on a fixed track in a fixed location, and it will attract a lot of people. One statistic you give is that Cradle Mountain in Tasmania, and what I think it's called the Overland Trail, is the most walked bushwalk in Australia. And then there's another one you talk about, I think it's the Three Capes track, which is apparently new as well. And it's and they seem to have these great luxuries on them, if you like. You can use USB, you mentioned yoga or something or other at one point. Can you comment on this movement? And then when you comment on it, could you also talk about the trade-off between drawing people into the wilderness, which could harm it, but then promoting the environment itself?
Yeah, it's really interesting tensions. I mean, the Overland Track has, you know, quite a long history going back into the 1930s. So we're talking about, you know, from Cradle Mountain to Lake St. Clair, that track there. But in the 1980s, a private company was able to build comfortable huts. So there are some other sort of national park huts that, you know, can get very crowded. I mean, when I did that walk, I preferred to sleep in a tent because I just didn't really like the idea of sleeping with a whole lot of people in a cabin. But yes, you can pay, you know, an extensive amount of money, a few thousand dollars, and walk with a company where you're staying in bushwalking standards, were quite luxurious accommodation, comfortable beds, meals cooked for you. You're only having to carry a light pack. So that sort of idea develops, you know, in Tasmania in the 1980s and other parts. But it's really become it's starting to become much more of a model now. So the Three Capes track opened a couple of years ago in Tasmania. It's a three-night, four-day walk. It originally was anticipated that it would be more like the overland. It would be sort of a longer, you know, the overland you can sort of do it in five, but, you know, you only want to take 6 or 7 days probably. And I think that and so, again, what you've got here, what you've got on the Three Capes track is you've got national park huts that are very, that have memory foam mattresses, they have the USB chargers. You still have to, you know, you're cooking your own meals, but you're carrying less because the cooking equipment is provided there, you know, because you've got a comfortable mattress. I mean, you're not carrying a tent. And so to walk the Three Capes track in those national park huts is around the sort of $500 mark, $495 for an adult. If you want to do the luxurious version, which is run by, you know, a private company, you're paying sort of more, $2,500-$3,000, and that's again where you're getting, you know, really nice meals being cooked, and one of them's got some sort of a plunge pool, like a small plunge pool at one of the overnight accommodation stays. And so so you're getting this real tension that's developing, and this is becoming a model for parks, national parks, not just in Tasmania. There's a number of other planned walks, tracks like this in Tasmania, but also it's taken off because the Three Capes track has been phenomenally successful in having these comfortable huts where you can walk relatively cheaply. You know, it's kind of more like a New Zealand experience, this idea, you know, having these kind of comfortable huts, but not, I'm not talking here about the luxurious ones. I'm talking about the sort of the $500 one. And it's just been so successful, obviously interrupted by COVID, but so successful for Tasmania's economy. And so, yes, other states are looking at this and saying, where can we do this kind of walking? So it's really happening elsewhere, as well as often wanting then to have, you know, commercial interests that wanting to set up the luxury walk. So it's... it's interesting because, as you say, it allows a much wider group of people to experience the bush, to experience locations that might be that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get to. But it is also bringing in. I mean, they need to do things like, you know, helicopters coming in to take out waste, for example. You know, yes, laying down. Tracks, raised tracks. So anything like that is going to change the ecosystem of places if you're introducing those sorts of things and introducing more people. So there is that potential damage to the environment that can be done. I think as well one of the issues is that if the money is spent on that kind of, you know, really expensive infrastructure, some of the other smaller low-key tracks, the more routine tracks, if you like, they're not getting the attention that they need either. So we're kind of getting these star tracks that are, beautiful, attracting people. I mean, it's a really a side of tension, particularly, some of the things that are developing where they are so expensive that they really are going to be for a very small number of people. There's that idea of like, do we have to make everything accessible? You know, can we not? I mean, I would say, can we not still not have places that, you know, that do require a bit of effort to get into? Yeah.
And I'd ask, we've got to finish up relatively soon, Melissa, but I think I'd like to finish on asking you about that in the sense of you give examples. It's as though once people work out that you can make tourism out of bringing people into the bush, then it becomes a race to see what tourist attractions you can get to bring people into the bush who would otherwise not come in. And it seems to move away from raised tracks and things like that very quickly to much bigger things that seem to have very little to do with actually being in the bush. So there's Scenic World at Katoomba, which is almost like a fun park on the edge of the Blue Mountains. And then there is mountain biking on ski runs, and there's the Lake Malbina development in the Walls of Jerusalem National Park in Tasmania that's a World Heritage Area, and they're thinking of, I think it's helicoptering or boating people into these areas that you could never otherwise go to. It seems as though there's, now that people have cottoned onto this idea, there's just no end to it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's where it does become, you know, I think really complex where you are. And again, because, you know, like the Lake Malvina one, I mean, that's still, you know, hugely controversial, hasn't the final approvals. It's been subject to court cases, et cetera. But, yeah, it's like that will helicopter people in and like it's very expensive, the planned idea. So it will be just for a small number of people. But, yeah, going into, like you say, these really remote areas and the idea of something like at Cradle Mountain too, there's been a lot of talk about having I've lost the word for it, but like on a ski resort where you have the cable car,
right?
You know, a cable car type system. So you know that the federal government actually a few years ago gave some money that was intended to go towards that in Tasmania. So yes, these sorts of attractions that do make the bush into like a theme park, and just really taking us away from what I guess, yeah, was at its core, which is about getting away and really just stripping back and experiencing the quiet and experiencing, yeah, nature and the, you know, the environment. And I think, and the other thing I think too, you know, that we can be, I think bushwalking has the potential to be a way that we can learn about Australia's Indigenous history and ongoing connection to the land, you know, so it has that potential. I'd like to see sort of more of that happening as opposed to, yeah, the sort of theme park money being invested in that kind of thing.
Well, thank you for your time today, Melissa. That's been great. And one, I would highly recommend this book to anyone who wants to just get a different perspective on the world. It opened my mind to thinking about this bush that, I kind of just took for granted or never, I always enjoyed looking at gum trees, but never really thought too much about the bush. And there's just so many aspects to thinking about the human's interaction with the bush socially, psychologically, environmentally. And I think it's an amazingly worthwhile book to read. And as I said at the start, above all that, it's just a good story. It's just, the book just works. It reads. It has a real narrative flow. And I think that's, well, for what it's worth, I think it's a wonderful achievement, Melissa.
Thanks. I really, that's really lovely to hear you say that because, I did really hard on telling a good story. So I'm glad I've succeeded.
Oh, good. And what have you got on, what's next for you in your academic career?
Well, I'm working on something quite different. I'm working on a history of dining out in Australia, well, particularly fine dining from the 1960s. So, again, something that we take for granted. You know, we've got this really interesting restaurant culture that we just think, oh, it's there, you know, and you can go out. So there, again, I think there's a great story to tell about how that's developed. You know, it hasn't just been in the last 20 years. It's not just because of MasterChef. There's a much longer history to the development of high-end restaurant dining. So that's what I'm working on now.
Oh, that would be excellent. I'm looking forward to that. Well, thank you, Melissa. That's Melissa Harper, everyone. The Ways of the Bushwalker is the book. I highly recommend it. And once again, Melissa, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Pete. It's been really great.